recapping from last week, I was just basically talking about the soul being the province of the shadow, that we were made to live up out of this fountain of identity that God has put inside of us. And yet, typically, because we don't have access to that when we're born, we compensate by living out of our souls and constructing this false identity and this illusory self. Our souls are basically the shadow's turf. It's what we call the flesh in the Bible. It's completely owned by the flesh and has a tendency to pull everything in towards itself instead of freely allowing love to flow outward through it. And the thing about the shadow that makes it so insidious is I pointed out last week that the enemy is not the devil. The enemy is your flesh. The enemy is the shadow, because it feeds on your thoughts, your emotions, your memories, everything you do, everything you experience. It feeds on that. That's what it builds the false self out of. So we can't fight this directly, because every tool we could use to fight it with is a tool that is part of what it is itself. And I concluded by saying that the only effective way to fight this enemy is to starve it to death. So this is the beginning of a series of teachings. I'm not sure how many there are going to be, but we'll get through it eventually. Basically, on the spiritual uses, historically speaking, of silence, darkness, contemplation, and I will end with a discussion of an experience called the Dark Night of the Senses, which is something that has been written about since 300 AD and is basically an application of all of these teachings on silence and darkness. So before we talk about silence, I have to talk about noise, okay? So last week I talked about the word multiplicity, and just to recap, multiplicity is simply the tendency to have our attention turned outward and scattered across a wide variety of things. But the frantic, multiplicitous clamor of the world we live in is a natural expression of the shadow. When you take my shadow and your shadow and your shadow and the shadows of all the people in the world who don't know God and are living up out of the life of God, when you add all that together, what you get is noise. You get a world that caters to people who are clamoring for entertainment, information, whatever. The lie that Adam and Eve believed, that we kind of were steeped in as we were growing up and are only just now learning how to unplug from, because it is the lie that is the foundation of our shadow, is simply this. You are not complete. You must add something to yourself in order to become something real. This is the fundamental lie that every human being believes. It's the lie that Adam and Eve accepted from the devil and handed on to us, and we have taken it hook, line, and sinker ever since. If all human beings are looking desperately for things to add to ourselves, without any thought for the consequence that has on the people from whom we're taking them, you have the world as we know it today. Okay? Science, the arts, education, industry, politics, every area of our lives has been infected by an insatiable desire to be more, to do more, to feel more, to think more, to know more, to have more. Basically, it's this greedy, acquisitive current that exists inside the soul of every human being that is the manifestation of the shadow. It's what the Bible calls the mind of the flesh, or the mind of the world. That is what it is. This greedy, insatiable trying to take and to fill and to experience, because you feel that if you can just find the right thing to add to yourself, then you will become something solid and existentially real. And this is kind of an aside, but not really an aside. Have you noticed that superhero movies are really popular these days? I mean, superheroes were a big thing in like the 50s, I think was the golden age, and then the 60s, Stan Lee started Marvel Comics. And now they're going through this massive revival, you know, where half the movies that show up in a given year are superhero movies. Well, I believe that the reason why they are so popular is because they're stories about ordinary people like us who have something extraordinary happen to them, and as a result, they become capable of stupendous things. They acquire power, they become important. Talk about something that's pitching right to the cry of the shadow. I need something, I need more power, I need to become significant or important. Well, I mean, that's what a superhero is. It's someone who had that happen to them. So we watch that and we walk out of the theater looking for the radioactive spiders and for the lab accidents that can make us into these things, you know? The whole point of all that kind of stuff is that it's basically about people finding a way to become important. And the desire for self-importance is the telltale grubby fingerprint of the shadow. That is what the shadow really wants. okay, so we naturally are turning outward looking for the thing that we can add to ourselves in order to be okay. So 20 years ago, there were 500 channels of cable TV. I don't even know how many there are right now. And there were 1,000 books being published each day. So how are you going to keep up? On your reading, on your viewing, there's just no way to keep up with it all. These days, okay, looking at internet marketing companies and the research that they've been doing, Facebook sees 500,000 comments, 300,000 status updates, and 150,000 photos posted every minute.
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to say day, but wow.
Minutes. There are 5 billion pieces of content uploaded to Facebook every day. How are you going to keep up? There are 350,000 tweets per minute. Per minute, okay? Instagram has 80 million photos posted every day and 3.5 billion likes, which means there were probably something like 6 billion viewings of those 80 million photographs. The thing is that the internet and social media, it basically gives you an awareness that stretches out over the entire world. You know, and so the internet is basically a factory for churning out noise on a galactic scale. I mean, this is more information than has ever existed in the entire history of the human race up until this point. Add it all together every single day. So if you're looking for noise, you can get lost in this, okay? If you believe the lie that the shadow tells you, which is that there's something out there that if you just find it will make your life okay, you will spend the rest of your life searching for a sense of meaning in a place where I can guarantee you, you will never find it. Okay? And am I saying you should disconnect your router and never look at the internet again? No, I'm not saying that. I'm just pointing out that if you have a problem with multiplicity, which is, again, this natural built-in tendency to look outward and to try and, you know, have your attention scattered between all these different things, opening up Google in your browser is like handing a crackhead the keys to the evidence locker at the police station. Okay? There is no lack of noise for you to try to attach to. There is no lack of places for you to look for significance if you haven't realized, as Solomon did at the end of Ecclesiastes, that it doesn't lie in anything that exists in the world. That it really can only be found in God. There's nothing you can know, nothing you can feel, nothing you can do, nothing you can remember or experience that will satisfy the greedy, hollow emptiness that is the shadow. Nothing. Absolutely nothing will satisfy it. Experiencing the love of God and living your life in agreement with the love of God is the only truly satisfying experience you can have as a human being, because that's what you were made for. We exist in this universe, which is an expression of the love of God, to receive an invitation from Him to participate in the love that He shares eternally and wants us to participate in. That's what it means that we're made in His image. Okay? And the problem is that all these greedy habits of the shadow will pull us relentlessly away from the experience of the love of God if we don't find some way to deny it. And by denial, I'm not saying, you know, we go off into a monastery somewhere or we start mortifying our flesh. Denying it, and Thomas Merton wrote this in one of his books, denying the flesh in this day and age really means turning away from the noise. Because if we don't make a deliberate movement away from noise and towards silence, we will just be wrapped up in this multiplicitous carnival until we die, continuing to try and look in a new place for a new thing or look at all the new stuff that scampers across the internet or through the contents of your soul, hoping that it will actually work, but it won't ever. See, the thing is that 100 years ago or 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago, when our lives were much smaller, you know, your awareness pretty much extended to the edge of your village. And, you know, if there was a war, then it extended a little further than that. But for the most part, your context was extraordinarily small. And it didn't take too long to run the gamut of all the things you could do or experience or hear or feel or think in the context of this narrow little environment before realizing, oh, actually, none of this is actually working, so maybe there's something else going on. But how are we ever going to arrive at that? 5 billion pieces of content a day, you could spend the rest of your life trolling the internet and never catch a fraction of that. So just fold now. So that's noise. The antidote for noise is silence. People in the modern world hate and fear silence. When there is prolonged silence, something's terribly wrong. This is dead air. it just gives us a sense that something is terribly wrong. Now, if you have small children, on the other hand, you recognize that silence is a gift of God and you don't ever want to have it, you know, taken away from you. This is all the people that have small kids are going, yes, amen, I hear that. But the truth is that people have always feared silence. Okay, there was a book I read about 15 years ago that was written by a Carthusian monk. Okay, so the Carthusians, they are a cloistered contemplative order. Okay, if there was ever a group of guys that were going to go establish a hermitage somewhere in the mountains, it's these fellas. They're basically descendants of the Benedictine order, or at least they follow the Benedictine rule. And they have dedicated themselves to isolation, solitude, and contemplation. In this book, he was writing about the experience of being part of this community, because that's what it is. It's not just a bunch of people locked up separate from one another like Alcatraz. Cloister contemplative monastery is essentially a community of people who are all gathered together around a common way of experiencing or seeking God, which in this case happens to be silent and contemplative. There are always people applying to join this order. And this guy said that the majority of the people who join turf out in 6 weeks. I mean, that's a faster dropout rate than the Marines. So contemplation, which I'm going to be talking about eventually, and we've talked about it often enough in here that you kind of have a general idea what it means. It used to be a common experience among Christians. It was kind of considered to be the entire point of Christianity because it's simply beholding and experiencing the presence of God directly, which is what we're here for, really. In about 1100 AD, contemplation was kind of taken out of the purview of the masses and just kind of marginalized and say, okay, the really holy people are going to do contemplation and everyone else, we need you out hustling. And after that, it just became more and more and more and more marginalized over time, so that the thing is that if you then decide in this day and age, especially, because it's really, really fringe right now, if you decide that you're going to apply to a contemplative order, it's like volunteering for training as an army ranger. It's like triple volunteer and really hardcore. Only the really spiritual people end up trying to be contemplatives because it has this reputation as being this big, intense, religious, you know, spiritual and religious thing. So the people who turf out in 6 weeks, they're not wimps. They're not drug addicts and people who are unregenerate sinners. These are the self-selected cream of the spiritual crop, okay? So why do they quit? This is why. The majority of time spent by a novice in a contemplative order, aside from the time that is spent in communal meals, prayer, or worship, all the rest of your time is spent alone in your room with not even a Bible to provide a distraction. Catherine of Siena, who is a theologian from Italy, who was writing, I think, in the 1300s to 1400s, she refers to this as the cell of self-knowledge. You are alone with your worst enemy, which is you, or more to the point, with your shadow. Okay, in silence and in isolation, without all the distractions that we fill our lives with, we are brought face to face with our worst nightmares. And it isn't the devil. It's us. Okay? So there was a quote that I read by Ruth Burroughs last week where she's talking about what it means for us as human beings to allow God to love us. Because the thing is that God has never hesitated in loving anybody. He's pouring himself out towards everyone all the time. We, generally speaking, don't. We're going like this. You know, back away. We don't really, you know, this makes me uncomfortable. You're my personal space, God. Please back up a little. So she says, to be loved means a naked, defenseless surrender to everything that God is. It means a glad acceptance of our nothingness, a look fixed only on the God who gives, taking no account of the nothing to whom the gift is made. That's us, by the way. The nothing. We're the nothing. To lose ourselves like this is the most radical of despoilations because the last shred of self-importance must be discarded. Okay, the shadow is all about self-importance, self-aggrandizement, self-actualization, self-realization, self-help. The self is all the flesh. It's all the shadow. It eats this stuff up. Everybody wants to be a Green Beret or a Navy SEAL or a superhero, something bigger than life, something powerful, something important. But in the cell of self-knowledge, when you come face to face with the shadow, the depressing knowledge you arrive at is that you essentially are nothing. It's the knowledge that Ruth Burroughs is talking about, that all your spiritual mojo doesn't count for anything, and basically that you're a complete and utter mess with no way out and no hope at all apart from the love of God. This is desperately humiliating, especially given that we've spent our entire lives away from God, and most of our lives, actually, after we're born again, trying to be holy. Okay, thinking that holy is something we could actually be. We've built ourselves up and prettied ourselves up and trained ourselves and disciplined ourselves and trying to be something, and then you come face to face with nothing in silence and isolation, and you realize that everything you've been doing is worthless garbage. And that's why they quit, because they can't deal with it. These are the people who think they're really spiritual, who think they're really holy. Quien es más espiritual, you know? And they come face to face with themselves in isolation, and they despair. Because they realize, as Ruth Burroughs is saying, that there is nothing at all in them that's at all worthy of receiving the love of God. We are the focus of the love of God because He chooses us, not because we're worth choosing. The value that we have as human beings is the value that He ascribes to us by giving Himself to us. We don't earn it. We don't deserve it. We never will. That's why it's called grace. This emptiness that you come face to face with in isolation is what Thomas Merton talked about in this quote from the New Seeds of Contemplation. I quoted this back when I was talking about the shadow and what it is. And he says, we are basically these hollow, empty centers that just kind of wrap bandages around ourselves, using the image of the invisible man. Wrap ourselves with experiences and actions and righteous deeds and all this other kind of stuff, trying to make ourselves existentially real. And yet all of those things will eventually pass away because they don't have their foundation in anything solid, i.e. in God. And his conclusion is that at the end of our lives, if that is what we continue to pursue, all these things disappear and there is nothing left of us but our own nakedness and emptiness and hollowness to tell us that we are our own mistakes. And this is what a novice contemplative is confronted with. All the ways in which they thought they were being good and spiritual and holy and doing the right thing and are really just wrapping more disintegrating bandages around the unreal hollow core of who they were. And it's like I said, it's desperately humiliating and most people can't take it. It is the reduction of the ego. Not the utter destruction of the ego, just the first time that the ego really suffers a major blow. Okay? So, has anybody here seen the movie Concussion?
Yes.
Okay. One of the things about Concussion, and again, this was kind of an inappropriately trivial or jocular thought. It's like all these guys are like they're suffering all this head damage and all that kind of stuff, and so they start hearing voices in their head. And you know, the voices are never good. You know, the voices are telling them to kill themselves or to kill their family or to do horrible things. It's like, why aren't there ever any good voices speaking in people's head? Luke 6:45, Jesus says that a good man brings up good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and an evil man brings up evil things out of the evil stored in his heart, for the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. Remember seeing a statistic, Jeremy Sinnott talks about it, Mark Verkler talks about it, 90 to 95% of your self-talk is negative if you're a normal human being. But whatever voice is speaking in your head, it's basically negative 95% of the time, which is a lot of the time, you know. And I'm wondering if this whole thing about concussion isn't just taking all those voices that are in the backs of our heads and just amplifying it until that's really all that's going on, until the subconscious negative self-talk is in the front of your head and it's conscious negative self-talk and you feel like you're just being bombarded by all these horrible things. And I believe that the reason why that's true is because it all boils up out of the shadow. You know, this is like the jetsam thrown up onto the shore of your mind by the shadow. The shadow owns your soul and everything in it, and your mind is part of your soul. So whatever is getting ejected from your subconscious, from this, you know, the shadow, illusory, ultimately hollow, vain, greedy, and selfish individual that we call the flesh, anything it's going to be tossing up is going to be pretty awful stuff. It's hedonistic, it's nihilistic, it's disconnected, it's isolated, it hates you, hates the fact of its existence, and it hates God. Because it's separated from him and it can't receive any life from him. That's the core that we continue to draw our lives up out of after we're born again, unless we make a deliberate effort to change our focus from all of the subconscious thoughts and all the things we naturally do and all the patterns of behavior that were established in our soul by the flesh in service of the shadow, and turn instead to this upwelling fountain of identity that we receive from God when we're born again. So, the way I think about it is, in the old Looney Tunes cartoons, you'd see these things where someone says, Isaac, I have to go pack. And he'll open up a suitcase and he'll take his entire apartment and jam it in the suitcase and then slam it closed. It is vibrating constantly and he's sitting on it, afraid that if he doesn't have, we've seen these cartoons, yes. Right? He's sitting on it and the moment he gets off, it blows up like that and everything comes back out. That's what we are, okay? God wants to come and fill us. He wants to let that upwelling fountain of identity flow out into us and fill us up. But we are jammed completely full of toxic lies and nonspecific filler. Noise is the tool we use to keep the lid on. Okay, it's the weight down on top of the suitcase, keeping it all bottled up inside so that it doesn't just kind of erupt. Okay, but the problem is then, of course, that once you're deprived of all the noise and the distractions, the subconscious mind just sort of erupts and spews all of the self-important filth of which the shadow is constructed out into the world for everybody to see. Silence allows for the evacuation of all of the empty, useless, and ephemeral things that the shadow has used to wrap itself in. And this should give you a hint as to why silence is really awesome. Because all of these things that we're attached to and focused on instead of the life of God are things that are really seriously killing us, literally killing us moment by moment by moment. Because if we don't draw our lives up out of God, there's nothing living in us to draw from. If we feed on ourselves, we're just getting more dead. Okay, if we feed on Him, we go from life to life, the way that Jesus experienced when He was here. So it is a gateway to serious freedom to allow this evacuation to take place. But it's also a terribly unpleasant experience. It shows us the truth, like, you know, the novices in this contemplative monastery. It shows us the truth that we're poor, pathetic, wretched, blind, and naked. And that we only have value because God chooses to be particularly fond of us, as they put it in the shack. It requires an atmosphere of grace, vulnerability, and transparency in order to work. Because without that, how are you going to dare to let yourself come completely unglued and be a complete mess? Right? You need a place where you can come unglued, where the nothingness that you are can be completely exposed, and yet you understand that the love of God is turned towards you anyway. Because, you know, we've grown up in a world that is completely obsessed with earning favor, earning approval. In order to earn approval, you have to do the right thing, and this is all not the right thing. All the stuff that's bottled up inside and stuffed down in here, it's all the wrong thing, which is why it's bottled up inside in the first place. And if we, even if it's something good, and yet we realize that it is just something we're using as a substitute for God, and therefore it has no actual value, if you eject this and say this has no value, and you're surrounded by an incentive system that says this is the thing that's valuable, you're basically a reproach to the incentive system, and they will beat you back into line, you know, to get you back in there. I had an image, a demonstration that I used to do when I taught about this 15, 20 years ago, where I would have a wine glass with a thin layer of olive oil on the top, a lot of red water below that. And I was saying, you know, when God starts to move inside the soul, it's like you're injecting corn syrup at the bottom, so it pushes everything up. And of course, the first thing to go is the layer of pretty golden oil on the top, and it exposes all the awful red junk that you've got inside of you. And at that point, you have to make a decision. Am I going to just cover it back up and stop this? Or am I going to allow myself to be vulnerable and transparent and let all the awfulness that is me be exposed so that it can be removed? Because the moment you try and put the lid on it, pretty it up, put a nice facade on top, and keep it clamped down, you stop everything that God's doing in the soul. It just stops dead. Okay? Vulnerability and transparency is the price of spiritual growth. If you are not willing to be vulnerable, if you are not willing to be transparent, you are not going to grow, because He needs to evacuate all the stuff that isn't real. But every place we're not vulnerable or transparent, we are not allowing what's real to be exposed. But the healing, you know, we experienced in the river, I mean, we came in here Sunday morning and Friday night over and over and over for weeks and months and years and just came unglued. And we were able to do that because the atmosphere in this place had been... Bill and Melinda had taught on grace, they'd practiced grace, the community of people who were gathered together here were living with one another on the basis of grace rather on the basis of performance and all this other kind of stuff. And so people could just get unglued and be total messes, and it was completely fine. There wasn't any shame or any, you weren't made to feel bad or inappropriate or anything for that. We realized, look, this is what people need. And the simple fact of the matter is that the mess that they are is something that God still is completely, particularly fond of. So, it's not our problem. And we would experience that. We would be lying on the floor with these memories surfacing or getting inner healing for this horrible stuff that had happened to us or the horrible decisions that we'd made. And the entire time that we're feeling wretched and awful and like total failures and like we don't amount to anything, we just feel the love of God pouring down on us like an anvil on our chest. This is what you need. You need to really practically understand that the love of God is turned completely towards you even when you're a total mess. Because the fact of the matter is, you've never been anything else. You are a mess and you will always be a mess. There is nothing in you that is worth the love of God. It's just that he chooses to give it to us, period. You find this kind of atmosphere in a relationship with a person, small group of people, or possibly a community of people, but you will never find it in an institutional setting. Never. Because as I mentioned before, in an institution, your value lies in the work you're getting done for the institution. And you are of no value if you are not doing that. This requires basically a cessation of your functional work. Your work becomes evacuation. This is not something that anyone gets anything out of except you. And so the institution is like, okay, will you get up off the floor now and start doing the work again? No, I mean, we heard this over and over and over, the constant criticism that was aimed not just at our church, but every church that was in the Toronto Blessing was, after 3 weeks of doing carpet time, lying on the floor experiencing the love of God, people were starting to get fidgety, going, well, we need to get out there and start witnessing. We need to go start doing something. We need to do something with this. It's like, will you just let God love people for once in the church? Will you just let him do this? But that is, again, that's the sign of the institution pushing, because it needs you to be working in order for it to get what it needs to continue to exist. So, conclusion, the devil's not the enemy, the flesh is your enemy. And if we're going to grow spiritually, we need to recognize the value of silence. We need to be free of the fear of what will happen to us when we are silent. Again, the fear is that all the nothing that I am will be exposed for everybody to see. Okay? That is the fear that keeps us desperately seeking noise to keep this thing repressed, okay? So you need to be in a place where you can allow yourself to be emptied out like that. And you need to be free of the fear that you will lose the loving attention of God if you allow that to be exposed. Now, the thing is that he knows it's all in there anyway. But yet somehow we feel like our confessing it makes it that much worse. We're a little bit crazy that way, but whatever. So you need to be free of this fear that there is anything in you that can make you unacceptable to God, because there isn't. Because there's nothing in you that can make you acceptable to God either. He loves you because he chooses to. It's his choice. It has nothing to do with us. And third, we need to make a deliberate effort to live our lives up out of the silence rather than simply in reaction to the noisy, compulsion-driven world that we're part of. Like I said, there's more than enough noise in the universe to fill every single second of every single day and leave you with nothing at the end of it. So we need to stop choosing that. When we see ourselves compulsively reaching out for something, acting in accordance with the shadow and the self-reference, to try and grab hold of something, believing if I just have this, I'll be okay, we need to recognize that it's a lie and stop living that way. And recognize that the alternative to living reactively that way is to just simply sit back and receive the life that is welling up inside of us as a result of having been born again. Every significant spiritual writer in the last 1700 or 1800 years of the Christian tradition makes it clear that if we are serious about abiding in God, which is the thing that Jesus said was the only thing that mattered, so we really should be serious about it, even though we're not. If we're serious about abiding in God, about living up out of the hope that's in him, being free from the tyranny of the shadow, silence is our only hope, okay? There's no hope in spiritual gifts. There's no hope in the Bible. There's no hope in preaching or doing the will of God or whatever. Your hope in being free from the shadow lies in silence alone. And silence is not a natural choice for human beings, especially if you have ADD or if you're an extrovert. I wish Mike was still here so I could ask him for his experience on this. See, I'm a melancholy, reclusive introvert. I love silence to death. I work alone, and I prefer it that way. And the funny thing was that Mike, who is a massive extrovert, who actually got disciplined on his old job for being up walking around talking to people when he was supposed to be doing drafting work, okay, he used to listen to me talk about this and say, yeah, you're a loon, and that's good if you're an introvert, but I'm not that guy. And now he's actually at a point where he's like, yeah, the silence is really awesome. This is an extrovert saying this. I wish he were here so he could say it himself, but I'm saying it for him. You can ask him to verify this next week. The silence is not a natural choice, okay? The shadow points you outward. Okay, the shadow that is believing the lie, I am not whole or solid or real, and in order to be that, I need to grab hold of something and pull it into myself. It is always turning your attention outward to the noise. Okay? It feeds on noise. Our fear of seeing the truth of what we really are, as I was saying before, assists that outward focus and the tendency to attach ourselves to external things and derive our identity from them, and to be just completely scattered and all over the map at all times. This isn't just something that happens to people with ADD. It's something we all actually struggle with. And it's simply because we are believing this lie and living our life in reaction to it. So if silence is our only hope, if silence is the thing we need to choose, if silence really is the gateway to moving from a life that's just controlled by and that's tyrannized by the shadow and, you know, living up out of the love of God, then we need to establish a habit of silence that can help us to separate us from the endless strident compulsivity that's in our souls as a result of just being human. Now, this is the consequence of the fall, right? So I'm going to be talking about soaking prayer. I'm going to be talking about centering prayer. I'm going to be talking about the parable of the pilgrim and contemplative darkness, which is the dark night of the senses. And just basically talking about how we can use those or establish those as habits inside of ourselves that can give us a way to stand outside of this raging hurricane of noise that is in our souls. It's in the world, but it's also in us. Until we step away from it inside of ourselves, we are just bound to the silence that's in the world. So I'm going to be talking about these different techniques and disciplines and how you can use them to step away from the noisy, compulsive habits of the shadow so that it can basically run itself down. Because the shadow is like a bicycle. If you stop pedaling it, it will eventually coast to a stop. It only works because you pay attention to it. It only works because you continue to feed it. If you stop feeding it, it will stop. Okay? And that is the point where we can really begin to experience the freedom of hearing the Holy Spirit speak without all the interruptions, without the distraction, without all this stuff. It's where we can really be free to be aware of the life of God inside of us and start learning to choose that and draw our lives up out of that. And more to the point, sink ourselves down into it so that when the noise erupts out there or in here, it doesn't just grab us and pull us along with it. Has anyone ever had a panic attack? Yeah, they're no fun at all. The problem with a panic attack is you have absolutely no control. It's like you're caught in a storm in a ship at sea and you're just being pulled along by the wind and by the waves and you're being tossed every which way and you have absolutely no control of it. You can't get out of it. It's really bad. When you develop these disciplines, establish yourself in a habit of silence, what you're really doing is you're withdrawing your understanding of yourself from everything that happens in your soul and pulling it into a place which is in the Spirit, which is completely enfolded in God, which understands love, which is content in the love of God, and which can basically endure all the storms of the soul and just go, well, that's interesting. How bizarre. I don't think I'm going to get involved in that today. And that kind of freedom is worth its weight in gold. Like I said, anyone who's ever experienced a panic attack, if I told you that there was a way you could just, like this, with a simple change of your attention, step out of that massive emotional storm and just be a complete peace. I mean, that's what this does. That's what living out of the Spirit does. Because when you're living out of the Spirit, you're no longer this weak, ephemeral thing just being tossed about by the patterns of your soul or by the things that are in the world. You are anchored to the deep solidity that is God, who has existed forever and will exist forever, who is the one thing in the universe that is solid and real, the I am, out of which everything else derives its life. When you are identified with that, when you are part of that, you cannot be shaken. When the Bible talks about the peace that passes understanding, that's what it's talking about. When he says it passes understanding, it seriously passes all understanding. Because being calm, transcendental meditation, is a way of making yourself calm. This isn't calm. This is utterly removed from everything that happens in your soul that isn't something that is God. Totally awesome. So we're going to talk about that next week.